Radio Buddhist Youth Association. Good afternoon, everyone. You're listening to the sound of universal compassion. Please enjoy.
This show is brought to you by the Buddhist Youth Association every Sunday, bringing Buddhism to the community of the Waikato. We also give away a range of free English or Chinese Buddhism books, MP3 or tapes on Buddhism. If you'd like one, please send a letter with $3 worth of stamps in an envelope to P.O. Box 82146, Highland Park, Howick, Auckland. Or you can phone 09271-3377. Buddhist Youth Association, respectful, beneficial, empowering. Hello and welcome to today's program. Last week we looked at some accounts of people who remembered previous lives as part of our contemplation on the third and fourth of the 6 points of suffering. You may remember that the first 4 points indicate that our existence is filled with uncertainty, is unsatisfying, involves dying again and again, and also therefore involves being born again and again. It was in the context of these last 2 points that we investigated past life memories. However, none of those accounts speculated on a continuity of lives stretching far into the past and just as far into the future. Of course, if we are convinced that we have had a life prior to this one, it's not so stupid to think we also had a life prior to that one, and then the regression can go on endlessly. Well, what would be our first life? And who made it come about? Such thorny questions may lead to a belief in a creator God. But that just leads to an equally thorny question about how God came about. To the answer that God was always there, one could then say, well, why couldn't all lives also always have been there, one after another, beginninglessly and endlessly? Then there would be no need for the existence of a creator God. Now, once we are convinced of the continuity of past and future lives, the question arises, well, what do I have to do to ensure that my lives increase in meaning and happiness and don't slide into meaninglessness and misery? His Holiness the Dalai Lama addresses this question in his commentary on the text we're following, Namkhar Pel's Mind Training Like the Rays of the Sun. He writes, "We also need to think about all the various lives and bodies we've had. Think, if we'd had human lives all the time, from the time of the Buddha up to now, how many bodies would we have taken? When we think about it, we are born, we try to accumulate a tremendous amount of possessions, we die. Then we are born again, we accumulate more things, we die again. We are born, accumulate more things, die yet again. It just goes on and on and on. If we think of all the milk we've drunk, the ocean isn't big enough to hold it all. If we were 50 years old, try to imagine all the food we would have eaten in all those 50 years, probably enough to fill a temple. And it has gone out as feces. How much feces have you released in this lifetime as well? If we haven't been able to take advantage of this existence, then it's like wasting our energy and our teeth, and we have unnecessarily caused a lot of pain to our jaws chewing things. So you see, it's quite important to try to see the actual reality of the situation in which we live, because when we're not aware of the reality, it causes a lot of problems. If we are born into this life as a pig, what good qualities do they have? They say pigs were born to be slaughtered, and this seems quite true. Even if it's not slaughtered, there could be a point in just keeping it to have some pleasure. But what to do with the pigs or the piglets? There's no beauty in their shape, they're so dirty, and it's just pathetic and pitiful. When people see a little puppy or a kitten, they say, oh, how cute. But when they see little pigs eating garbage and feces, they don't say how cute. They just hold their nose. So, if we've made no use of our life and have spent our lifetime eating a tremendous amount of garbage, like a pig, food or whatever, what was the point of all we've done? And we've been doing this for beginningless lifetimes. His Holiness then implies that the Tibetans are suffering today under the Chinese because of their own unruly behaviors in the past. He says, look at all the times the Tibetans have warred with the Chinese. Sometimes the Tibetans would catch Chinese, tie them together by the hair, and then sit on them. They used many other brutal ways of torture too. This is in the history books. If we look at some accounts of the past, we can find some amazing and horrifying things that occurred. In the collected works of the fifth Dalai Lama, we find the account of a particular attendant of the first Dalai Lama who was reborn as a bird. If we can believe some accounts, this person was later born again as a very great guru, Suchicho, through different rebirths. So, from this type of example, we can see that we've been born here and then there in all types of situations, just as in a child's game, landing in different places on the board, or as in gambling with dice, different throws coming up, and we're constantly taking births by the force of our delusions and karma. If the situation were just like a plant or a tree in a field, we cut it and it grows, we cut it and it grows. There's no point. There's nothing that the plant can possibly do except constantly to grow and be cut down, grow and be cut down. Whereas here in our case, something can be done about it because our changing rebirth situations are under the influence of our mental continuum. And the mental continuum is under the influence of the various impulses and karmic potentials that are built up in it. So we can actually do something about changing the potential in order to break the pattern. We're not just puppets. We've taken many different types of rebirth, but how many times have we actually been able to take the essence of a meaningful rebirth and make it worth having? And how many lives have we just wasted? The millions and billions of rebirths that we've had without taking advantage of any of them, this is really pathetic. We need to think how we've taken countless bodies, yet up to now, we've never taken real advantage of them. And this way, we need to develop a feeling of disgust with ourselves. Being born over and over with no respite, taking countless bodies, good and bad, again and again, trying to fathom this endless round of births, contemplating it, can be a basis for developing renunciation, a determination to be free from the uncontrollable recurring cycle of birth and death. Now, I think it might be difficult to imagine ourselves in some of the existences described by the Buddhist cosmology, like pretas, hell beings, asuras and zuras, but we can certainly imagine what it must be like to be an animal or some kind of human in a very difficult situation. YouTube has many videos of animals hunting and killing other animals, of insects trapping and eating other insects and small creatures. We can watch such things vicariously with a sense of remove and be thrilled or horrified. But perhaps it would be better to watch them as if we ourselves were the victim or the aggressor. What would it be like to be an antelope attacked by lions, or even a lion attacked by other lions? Really, imagine yourself in that situation. When we want water, we turn on a tap. It's as easy as that. We're in very little danger and can really enjoy our drink. But what about an antelope, for instance? What would it be like every time you needed to drink, you knew you were at your most vulnerable? You could be attacked by predators from land or from the water itself. From time to time, I watch live cameras on africam.com, a website that allows you to watch animals at various waterholes in South Africa. When most of the animals come to drink, especially the antelopes, they are very wary. They constantly keep a lookout and are very picky about what point on the shore of the waterhole they're going to drink. And then often they will drink a few mouthfuls before looking up and gazing around to make sure all is still safe. The slightest noise out of the ordinary and they're ready to leap away, even though they may not have finished drinking yet. And if they do have to leave, that's it for the day, whether they're still thirsty or not. No more water until tomorrow. What would it be like to live your life like that? And yet we have, many, many times in the past. In that type of life, we have no control over what happens to us, and we can do practically nothing to escape our karma. We just have to live through it. In one clip, I saw a deer that had been caught by a pride of lions. It was still very much alive, while one lion was eating its back legs. The other lions were just hanging out around it, while the cubs practiced their killing skills on it, grabbing it by the throat and holding on as lions do to suffocate their prey. Of course, the cubs were not strong enough to kill it, and so it had to endure being eaten alive and harassed by the cubs until Shock, or one of the older lions, put it out of its misery. The deer was completely at the mercy of the lions and its own karma, as we are if we don't make an effort to put a stop to this whole sorry cycle of existence. Now, as His Holiness says, our life is not uncontrolled like that of the deer. As humans, we can do something to put a stop to being eaten by lions and worse. If we really put ourselves in the place of the deer and know that we will have to experience that kind of death again and again and again and again, we might get the impetus to do something different when our habitual patterns and karmic imprints urge us to act in ways that will only bring us and others harm and suffering. The question is, are we willing enough to make the determination and put in the effort? Or are we satisfied to once again relax back into our habitual patterns, which is often so uncomfortable and yet so familiar? And now we've gone long enough without at least considering our motivation for the program today. Let's take a moment to look at our motivation and adjust it accordingly if we find something small and miserly in it. One practice that really helps us to move away from samsaric existence is to always set a vast and beneficial motivation. And, as has been said many times by many great masters, the best motivation is bodhicitta, the desire to attain enlightenment, to be the greatest benefit to all beings everywhere. So let's set that as our motivation if possible. If not, at least to attain enlightenment for ourselves. Thank you. So apart from the motivation, we have covered the third and fourth points of the 6 points explaining samsaric suffering. The fifth point is that in samsara, we are constantly changing status. We can never rise to a high level and then be absolutely sure that we will not fall to a lower level ever again. In terms of lives, this means that in one life, we can be a king, in the next, a beggar. We have no certainty of status at all. There's a story about King Ashoka that bears this out. Ashoka is often seen as the greatest king India ever had. At first a bloodthirsty empire builder, he later converted to Buddhism and became a ruler dedicated to peaceful means and cooperation among his many subjects. India prospered under his benevolent rule, and he did many excellent things that boded happy karmic results. However, at his death, it is said a mind of anger arose because he felt he wasn't being accorded enough honor for everything he had done, and that one angry thought spurred him to rebirth as a large and ferocious crocodile. In one life, the admired king over a large, prosperous empire, the next, a crocodile living in a dirty river. Later on, his good karma would catch up with him, and he would again be born into high status. Now, is this all true? Well, I cannot say, for I was not there for the whole time. But it does illustrate the point that after death, even the highest and most loved king can become something no one except another of its own kind wants to go anywhere near. Of course, it's difficult to find verified stories that show how people rise and fall, rise again and fall again, as they move through endless lives. However, you may remember a case investigated by Dr. Stevenson I talked about early in the series of programs on mind training like the rays of the sun. It was the case of Gopal Gupta, a boy born to a lower middle class family in 1956. When Gopal was about 2 years old, his father asked him to remove a glass of water a guest had used, but Gopal refused, saying that he was of the Sharma caste, one of the highest castes in India, and he threw a temper tantrum during which he broke some glasses. When his father had questioned him, he revealed details of a previous life in the city of Mathura. He said that he'd owned a company selling medicines, he'd had a wife, and lived in a big house with many servants. One day, he quarreled with one of his two brothers, who shot him. Now, I've been through Dr. Stevenson's report on this case quite extensively in a previous program, but I brought it up here again because of Gopal's claim that he'd been a high-caste Sharma in his previous life. Sharmas did not do things like touch utensils other people had touched, and this is why he refused his father's request to remove the water glass. Dr. Stevenson writes, along with his statements about the previous life, Gopal showed behavior that a wealthy Brahmin might be expected to show, but that was inappropriate for his family. He did not hesitate to tell other family members that he belonged to a caste superior to theirs. He was reluctant to do any housework and said that he had servants for that. He would not drink milk from a cup anyone else had used. And now you can imagine that such behavior went down like a lead balloon. But Dr. Stevenson reported, as Gopal became older, he slowly lost his Brahmin snobbishness and adjusted to the modest circumstances of his family. He gradually talked less about his previous life as Shaktipal Sharma, but as late as 1974, his father thought that Gopal still remembered much about it. So here we have a case of someone being born in a high status in one life, but then falling to a lower caste in a following life. Although the effects on Gopal and his family are sketchy, his airs and graces probably caused quite a lot of disharmony and unhappiness. And this indicates the suffering referred to in the fifth of the 6 points of suffering, the uncertainty of status. Now, I've even heard of a story about a Buddhist teacher who was popular with a lot of Western students. When the teacher died, some of his students went to a very high lama and wanted to know where their teacher had been reborn. Now, the lama wouldn't say, and told them more or less to not worry about the teacher's rebirth, but to practice as he had instructed them. However, the students were insistent, and eventually the lama asked them, "Now, do you really want to know where your teacher is? You may regret it." The students were adamant, and so the lama told him to go to one hill in the countryside and call out their teacher's name. The students duly made their way to the hill, but when they shouted out their teacher's name, a yak came bounding up to them. A yak is a kind of cow-like animal that's very common in Tibet. So, in one life, a highly respected and popular teacher. In the next, a yak whose destiny is probably to be slaughtered for its meat and skin. Even being a good and respected teacher cannot save us from falling to the lower realms. In his commentary, His Holiness says, the next point concerns how people can lose their status and go from high to low or low to high. Being born as human, we can be great rulers, high officials, and so forth. Then, because of circumstances, we fall to become slaves. Or beings as gods can fall to the worst realms. We can see very clearly from the examples of people around us how one can fall from high to low, or can rise from low to high. So we need to look at ourselves and consider our situation. We have a working body with a higher status rebirth, and out of the highest status rebirths of being either human or God, we have a human rebirth which is best. Now this brings to mind a story in the Huffington Post about a famous figure skater and surgeon due to tell her story on one of those Fix My Life TV shows. Her name is Debbie Thomas, and this is what the article in the Huffington Post says. From the time Debbie Thomas was a young girl, she wanted to grow up to become two things, a renowned figure skater and a practicing physician. She did both. In the 1980s, Thomas captured the world's attention from the moment she got onto the ice. While studying for her engineering degree at Stanford University, Thomas won both the US and world championships. She soon set her sights on Olympic gold. Though her stumbles at the 1988 Olympics in Calgary cost her first place, Thomas took home the bronze and became the first African-American athlete to medal at any Winter Olympics. Then, after a successful figure skating career, Thomas went on to fulfill her second dream. She became a board-certified orthopedic surgeon, eventually opening up her own private practice in Richlands, Virginia. Today, however, Thomas's successes seem worlds away. In between the Olympics and the World Championships, Thomas got married, but says the relationship crumbled after just 3 years because her husband felt lost in the midst of her popularity. As with her professional stumbles at the Winter Games, Thomas considered this personal stumble to be a failure. Then, more failures. As a physician, Thomas says her high expectations led her to go head-to-head with colleagues, and she was let go from two jobs. Though she had never really wanted to open up her own practice, she did. And that's when another divorce led Thomas to lose her nest egg, she says, and she soon had to close her private practice after 2 years. Thomas is currently broke, jobless, twice divorced, and living in a bug-infested mobile home in a trailer park with her fiancé and his two sons. She even lost custody of her own 13-year-old boy, and her fiancé struggles to control both his alcohol use and his anger. Thomas knows it's time to turn her life around, so she asks life coach Jan-Le Van Sant to help her face some harsh truths on a path towards healing. Because Thomas's own trailer is so disorderly and infested with bedbugs, she and Jan-Le meet in Jan-Le's RV to have a frank conversation about how Thomas's life dissolved into its current state. You got to a point where you couldn't afford to do anything other than live in a trailer. Is that what I'm hearing you say? Jan-Le asks. Yeah, I guess that's about right, Thomas admits. Jan-Le asks the 48-year-old how it makes her feel to live in a trailer. Thomas's answer shocks her. I feel frustrated, Thomas says. Frustrated, Jan-Le repeats. Not sad, not angry, not ashamed. No, Thomas responds. Not guilty that you've got a man, two kids, and a bedbug infestation in a trailer, Jan-Le continues. Frustration is what you feel, nothing else. Thomas shakes her head, and Jan-Le gets ready to share the harsh truth she believes Thomas needs to hear. This is what I know. You're living in a trailer in the Appalachian Mountains, and your son ain't with you, Jan-Le shouts. You're raising somebody else's children. So you can tell me whatever you want to tell me. Telling yourself the truth is important. Now, I personally feel there's something a little suspect about TV shows like this, but the story serves to show quite well how easy it is to fall from a place of prominence in our type of existence. Whether it is personal failings or external circumstances or a combination of both, it doesn't take much to turn repute into disrepute. And is it impossible for Jan-Le Van Sant to turn Debbie's life around once again? No, of course not. Debbie might not become again the world's top figure skater or a highly renowned surgeon, but she could still build a life distant from a bug-infested trailer and the anger of a drunken partner. Or she could sink even further. In Buddhist terms, of course, as His Holiness says, it would be best if she started following a spiritual path and give some real meaning to her life. How much does her US and World Championships and her Bronze Olympic medal matter now? How much does it matter that she was a top surgeon? Perhaps if she'd looked for guidance on a spiritual path, she wouldn't have lost two jobs, her practice and her son. She might have avoided the physical abuses she and her partner traded with each other. Certainly, there would be more meaning to her life, and she would have had the chance of going in a much more positive direction. Interestingly, with an inkling of spirituality, Debbie claims that she wants her life to be a cautionary tale to others, and says that what happened to her can happen to anybody. Anybody out there who thinks they're safe and has it under control, they're not, she says. And that's just what Namkar Pell is pointing out in Mind Training Like the Rays of the Sun, only he does it on a much more cosmic scale. Once again, he quotes Nagarjuna's friendly letter to a king with these verses. Having been chakra, worthy of the world's veneration, one falls again to earth through the force of action. Or having been a universal monarch, one again becomes a servant in cyclic existence. Having long experienced the pleasure of fondling the breasts and hips of celestial maidens, one undergoes the unbearable contact of the crushing, cutting, and slashing operations in hell. Think of how, following the pleasure of the grounds yielding at the touch of your feet, while dwelling long on Meru's peak, the unbearable suffering of the fire pit and the swamp of filth will strike again. Having frolicked in lovely, pleasant gardens, waited on by celestial maidens, Again, your arms, legs, ears, and nose are cut in the forest of trees with leaves like swords. After resting in gently flowing streams on golden lotuses with beautiful celestial maidens, again you fall into the unbearably caustic boiling water of the infernal fordless river. Having attained the magnificent pleasure of celestial realms and even Brahma's bliss of detachment, again you undergo endless suffering. As kindling for the fires of the hell without respite, when you have attained the state of the sun or moon, the light of your body illuminates the entire world. But on returning to darkness again, not even your outstretched hand can be seen. And then finally, Namkar Pel quotes from the Transmission of Discipline Sutra, "The end of all accumulation is exhaustion. The end of being high is to fall low. The end of meeting is separation. The end of life is death." In the first verse, he says that we can be born as Shakra, another name for Indra, king of the gods. But then when that karma is over, another ripens and sends us tumbling back to a base earthly existence. In one life, we can become a universal monarch, the king of a whole universe. So you can imagine how great such a birth that is. But in the very next life, we could find ourselves the most humble of all servants. Then Nagarjuna contrasts being born in the company of the most delightful and desirable people to being crushed, slashed, and cut in the hell realms. Both will happen to us repeatedly if we don't make an effort to get out of cyclic existence as fast as possible. Nagarjuna then says it would be wonderful to walk barefoot on the top of Mount Meru, a sacred place for Buddhists where the earth is soft and yields to our every footstep. But if we haven't purified our karma, we can end up once again in the great pit of fire or wading through a swamp filled with every type of filth, from feces to spit, from blood to entrails. Then in the next verse, he contrasts playing in beautiful gardens while you're waited on by stunning maidens with being forced to climb the trees in the forest of trees with leaves like swords. In this forest, you hear the voice of your beloved crying for help at the top of a tree. You climb up to help your beloved, but as you do, the sharp leaves point downwards, cutting you severely. And then when you get to the top, instead of seeing your beloved, you're attacked by birds with sharp beaks. The leaves of the trees point now up, slashing at your body as you climb down. But at the bottom, suddenly appear huge wild dogs that attempt to eat you alive. He then describes one life in heaven, bathing in gentle streams, once again waited on by celestial offering goddesses, but in the next, stumbling into the boiling and very caustic water of the hell realms. The hell of no respite is the worst hell, where it's impossible to tell your form from the flames of the great fire, but you cannot sleep, die, or lose consciousness at all. And finally, he says that in one life, your body might be like the sun or moon in its radiance, but in the next, without purified karma, you are born into Stygian darkness so thick you cannot see your hand in front of you. Just because we're in a wonderful situation in one life doesn't mean we will find ourselves there again in coming lives. Our very next life could be the very opposite of what we've been enjoying. As His Holiness says, we need to think about the ups and downs of cyclic existence deeply again and again to get over our fascination for it. And with that, we must say goodbye, for now our time is up. Thanks for joining the program today, and please let's get together again next time. In the meantime, have a wonderful week, and as we go, let's dedicate any positive potential from the program today to gaining enlightenment for the sake of all beings. Thank you, and goodbye.